Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. It's very nice to see you all here. Thank you for coming. I am doing a joint function today. I'm standing in for the Honorary Secretary, but we've done it so often together now that I guess I probably know the procedure. There are some 69 fellows and members either here or who've been and looked at the material this afternoon. There are three guests, and I, without putting names to them, I will remind one of the guests that there is a limit to how many times you come as a guest, but I did warn you, you ought to be becoming a member. And amongst the guests, I'm very pleased that Harvey's wife Carol is with us, so it's jolly nice to have you here too. Thank you for coming. And we've got a number of visitors from over more or less water. I've told Thomas Barringer that as he's such a regular attender and does all his hard work next door for the expert committee, that I've appointed him an honorary Brit, so he will cease to be listed every time we come to these occasions. With apologies if I do not pronounce some names correctly, but if they're still here, please can we welcome Klaus Schöpfer, who's at the back there. Wolfgang Hellregel, who's also at the back. Rolf Dieter Jurecki, he's gone to catch a plane. Thomas, who I'm not welcoming again. Bob Odenweller, who's almost as frequent a visitor. And Alexander Heyman, who is not only here from the United States, but is a new member as well. Making his first visit. Now, it's been my practice over recent time to try say a little appropriately about our speaker, our guest. I guess there are quite a lot amongst you that know Harvey better than I do, although we've come to know each other on a few occasions, both here and in New York, and I've enjoyed every one of them. Of course, Harvey is now a leader in the philatelic fraternity in the United States, which is great. But like my friend sitting in the second row, he's a relative newcomer to philately, I discover. To have put this amazing collection together in just a few years since the early 90s bowls me over. And I can only say that I started at a much younger age, and I wish I had a collection that was as comprehensive and looked like this. So no doubt we'll hear more about that in due course. Now, Harvey is somebody who is well known as an international exhibitor, who's now in the championship class, and he's won grand awards in the USA. He has a history that I discovered, to my surprise, brought him to live for 6 months even in London. And that was when he was working some long time ago for Procter & Gamble in Paris, and when the corporate world perhaps still had some appeal, not for long. And then he tried teaching business and subsequently became a marketing advisor to the pharmaceutical industry. And I can only say he must have been a great success, because he wouldn't have been collecting this stuff the way he has if he hadn't. So, Harvey, it's wonderful to have you here. Thank you so much for having struggled over, despite the snow and the weather. At least it was all right at this end. which was more than could be said when I came back from Africa 3 weeks ago. So it's over to you. We look forward to hearing from you about your beautiful material. Thank you.
Thank you, John, for the lovely explanation of my background. Before I begin, allow me to say that reading a paper to the Royal Philatelic Society is indeed a great honor. And this is certainly one of the highlights of my philatelic career today, and I'm very, very grateful for it. The fact that it is also being presented as this year's Sir Daniel Cooper lecture just adds that much more luster to an already great distinction. So thank you, Mr. President, thank you, committee, and thank you all for being here today. I must also say that I was not familiar with the seating arrangements, and I thought that people in the seats would have a full view of all the frames, and all I really had to do was use the pointer and point them out quickly. But I realize now that many of you do not have that kind of a view. I know many of you did see the covers before we began to see this afternoon, and the president tells me that he will leave them up for a little while after my paper. So if there's something that I mentioned that you want to see, please take the opportunity to see it. Let me begin. In 1845, the United States, following the lead of Great Britain, began a great postal reform movement. The first important action taken with regard to that movement was to reduce postage rates and to apply those rates in a consistent manner. Previously, postage rates were calculated based on a very complicated system of the number of pages, the distance being traveled, and there were numerous breakpoints in those distances. So, for example, a letter going to Philadelphia from New York City, a distance less than 60 miles, would pay 6.5 cents for postage if it was a single sheet. If it were two sheets or three sheets would be 18¾ cents. That's in 1840s, 1830s. Very, very expensive. So it was not easy to use the mails. It should also be noted that at that time, mail was allowed to be sent unpaid. The expectation was that the recipient would pay the postal charges. However, what would happen is very often the recipient, the addressee, would simply refuse to accept the letter. And so you'd have a letter that was carried hundreds, perhaps thousands of miles, it would be left back with the post office. So as you might imagine, this was a tremendous loss of revenue and was a major component of the annual deficits being incurred in those years by the Postal Service. In general, you can see this was a complex system. It was unwieldy for local postal officials to know how many sheets were involved, what if it was sealed, how many rates, what was the distance involved. It was very complicated for the local postmaster, local postal clerk. And at the same time, the actual charges on this system were not helpful at all to commercial interests. It was expensive to keep their mail flowing, and certainly to the general public, which hardly used the mails in those days. The legislation introduced in 1845, however, changed all that. Postage rates were dramatically reduced to 5 cents per half ounce for letters traveling up to 300 miles and 10 cents per half ounce for letters going beyond 300 miles. Not only were these rates much lower, but they were also weight-based. They were per half ounce. So it made it consistent and very easy to apply. You weighed it, you saw it was more or less than 300 miles, and that was it. One rate for each half ounce, 5 cents up to 300 miles, 10 cents beyond. So with this legislation in place, it was not surprising that the U.S. had the same experience that Great Britain did, namely that the use of the mails increased significantly, and that was, of course, very helpful. So in 1845, in order to make it even easier, 1847, 2 years after the new rates, Congress, in order to make it even simpler or easier for you to use the mails, took the next step. Specifically, they authorized the Postmaster General to produce and sell postage stamps in denominations of 5 cents and 10 cents. The new stamps were meant to be a convenience for the public by adding flexibility in mailing schedules. You didn't have to go only when the post office was open. You could go after hours and drop it off in the slot. And there was some hope that maybe because there were these new stamps available, it would encourage the prepayment of postage, because this loss of revenue was getting to be a serious matter. In fact, it threatened the post office viability in that time. So those were the intentions, to make it a little easier and to make it more convenient for the public and the commercial interests to use the mails and not use the private mail systems, which were the other great threat. Notwithstanding those intentions, it is the hypothesis of my display that the new adhesives ended up being far more than just a convenience. My hypothesis is that even though the 1847 stamps were used on only about 2% of all mail during their currency, 1847 to 1851, and although they were only available at about 4% of the post offices in the United States, the facts show that the stamps were used in every part of the country to carry mail that went to every destination to which mail was then carried. Furthermore, adhesive stamp mail served every purpose and received every service that stampless mail received. In short, adhesive stamp mail, that is to say, prepaid mail, demonstrated that it could do everything that stampless mail could do, and even more than that. So, in other words, it became obvious after a point that you really didn't need stampless mail anymore. And that, of course, had enormous implications in terms of profitability for the government. It would put them on the right side of the ledger. The design of my display is to show that after these stamps were, in fact, put to practical use, they showed that there really wasn't a need for stampless mail. And that, in fact, changed the system. The way I put it together there are 8 sections to my display. Each section deals with a major aspect of postal usage, postal service, and shows that within that context, the mail with stamps, with postage stamps, were the same, did everything that you would expect from a stampless letter. And so that when you look at the totality of it, I think it shows the point. Let me discuss the actual display. The first section shows the stamps being used for their intended purposes, namely the prepayment to postage. So it shows 5-cent and 10-cent stamps singularly and in combinations to pay multi-rate charges. And it shows not only normal usage of the stamps for paying single letter rates and double and triple letter rates, but also the rate to California, which is a special legislated rate of 40 cents. There's an example of that. Also, mail from Panama, where the United States had a mail dispatch agent, it was included in the legislation at 30 cents per half ounce, and there's an example of that. There are also examples of the stamps being used for other categories of mail, what we call drop letters, a letter that was brought to a post office and would be picked up at the same post office. That was only 2 cents. Or a circular, which was sent at a lower rate, the third-class mail, if you will, junk mail, as we call it today. There's even an example of mail that could have gone free, but the sender put a stamp on it. So you can see through that the versatility of the new stamps. There are, in that first frame, there are a few items that are special favorites of mine. One is right on the second page, and I realize you won't see it very well over here. It's in those days, of course, as I'm sure you all know, paper was in short supply. It was expensive, scarce. So some stationers would print up letter sheets, and you'd come to the store and you'd pay them a penny and you'd get the letter sheet and you'd write your letter and fold it up, send it off. Well, this is a letter sheet from a stationer in Boston. And the top of it is very, very attractive. It's got a map of Boston as it was then constituted. And then on one side, there's census information going back a number of years. And then on the other side, it tells you the rates of postage. 5 cents per half ounce for letters going up to 300 miles and 10 cents beyond that. And that's just what this man did. He wrote a letter to Putney, Vermont, which was less than 300 miles away, folded it up, and put that same 5-cent stamp, just as the letter sheet instructed him to do. Another interesting pair of covers are the ones to Mary Stilfen. Miss Stilfen was away from her hometown, and she received mail There are two covers to her. They happen to illustrate the two ways that you could pay 5 cents postage, with a 5 cent stamp, of course, and unauthorized but accepted a bisected 10 cent stamp. And there's one of each of those, both addressed to Mary Stoph, and they're from two different people. The one on top was from the Reverend Foote, whom we know eventually married Mary. The one on the bottom, we don't know what happened to that gentleman. There are other letters in the correspondence from him, but we don't know the outcome of. We know that he didn't get to marry her. Another cover that will be particularly interesting to British collectors or students of Britain postal history is this one here. It's the only time domestic rates changed in the United States. What happened was when the 1848 Transatlantic Treaty was completed with England, they requested that we use their system for assessing rates so that it was one rate for the first half ounce, two rates for up to an ounce, and then two more rates up to the second ounce. In the U.S., we had been doing it per half ounce. They asked us from this point forward, starting with the first ounce, it should go by two rates at a time. And we agreed to that, the United States did. And this letter went from Pottsville, Pennsylvania, to New York City, to a famous family name in New York, the Heckschers. And what happened was, it was obviously a triple weight letter, ounce and a half, between an ounce and a half, and the sender put 3 5-cent stamps on it. The postmaster said, oh no, he wrote, do five, because it was post the treaty with Great Britain, and now you had to pay 10 cents between 1 ounce and 2 ounce. So it's an oddity in U.S. Stamp rates, and it's all due to the treaty with Great Britain. There are other interesting ones in here. There's an example of combination postage, 5 cent and 10 cent used on the same cover, which are considered very desirable, and they are interesting. There's also an example, the only one, of two pairs of stamps, a pair of 5 cent, a pair of 10 cent, used on the same cover. It's the only example like that. And if you have seen it, you know my theory that perhaps this was a fraudulent reuse of the pair of 10-cent stamps, because they're cut off just across the top and they're awkwardly placed on the cover. And this was a commercial firm that would be receiving a lot of mail and probably just took the stamps off and reused them. It makes it a little bit more glamorous, but not terribly legal. The second section illustrates the many post office accommodations and services that were afforded to mail bearing the 1847 first issue. The objective is to show that letters using the new stamps were given the same recognition as stampless mail and that they enjoyed the complete range of postal operations and services that were available at that time. It goes beyond that. It shows that they could do things that were more than went on at that time. For example, the ways of paying postage. Once again, there are examples of bisected stamps. In this case, now we have a horizontal bisect and a vertical bisect. The one to Mary Stilton was a diagonal bisect. There are covers where the sender brought it to the post office with a 5 cent stamp, and the postal clerk said, oh no, this requires 10 cents. So we paid the other 5 cents in cash, part stamp, part cash. There are examples where the letter was dropped in the slot with only a 5 cent stamp, and the postmaster realized, oh no, this requires 10 cents. So he marked it 5 cents due, and the recipient paid the extra postage that was due on it. There are examples of waymail. I don't know if that's a British system or not, but it was waymail was letters that were given to a postal carrier on his way between one post office and the next, and you paid one penny for that service. And there are examples of that. There are examples of mail that was missent. That's to say that the post office sent it to the wrong post office, so they had to correct that, and of course it was at their expense. There's also examples of forwarded mail. And interestingly, in that era, you had to pay the extra postage for forwarding a letter. That changed in 1875. Now you can forward a letter and they don't charge you again. But then you had to pay the extra postage for the forwarding process. Cover that I'm especially proud of is this one down here, the registered cover. Registered mail didn't come into being in the U.S. till the late 1850s. But there was an informal system between certain postmasters regarding registered mail. And this is the only adhesive-stamped cover, only 1847 cover, and the earliest example of an adhesive-stamped cover bearing the word registered. There are other covers with a large letter R. In fact, this has it too. That was for incoming registered mail to Philadelphia. That's the other way we can demonstrate registered mail, the large R in Philadelphia. That's the only other way. This one happens to have both because it came from Wilkes-Barre. It was marked hand-stamped registered, and when it arrived in Philadelphia, it was marked with the R. So we have double validation of the fact that it was a registered letter. And historically, it's quite an important letter. The third section of the display is a geographic one. It's to show that the stamps were used from everywhere. When the 1847 stamps were first issued, there were 29 states in the Union. During the currency of the stamps, two additional states joined the Union, Wisconsin and California. There are letters extant, covers extant, from every state in the Union and the District of Columbia, which then, as now, was capital of the United States. So I like very much that I'm able to begin. The first page of that section is a cover from St. Augustine, Florida, to Savannah, Georgia. St. Augustine, those of you who know your American history, you realize that St. Augustine is the oldest continuously populated city in America. So we have an example of the first stamp sent from the first city. And it's the only one from St. Augustine, so I'm very, very happy with that one. Interestingly, too, if you look at the postmark, you'll see that it says Florida Territory. Florida was no longer a territory, but the postmaster just didn't want to, you know, spend the money to get a new hand stamp, so he used Florida Territory. And it goes on to show stamps for small town usages. And then it shows large town usages from every region of the country, from the New England states, from the Mid-Atlantic states, from the South, from the Midwest, from the then western frontiers of Chicago and St. Louis. And the point being that there are stamps, as I said, from every section, from cities large and small. There are even, at the last page, shows some covers from cities that don't even exist anymore. One was wiped out by a flood, and the other was bypassed commercially in the 1850s and just ceased to exist as a separate unit. It had to join up with a nearby city. So although, there, as I said before, there are only about 2% of all letters, adhesive stamp mail was used in every state and in every possible way and for every reason. Regardless of where one lived or what purpose the letter served, you could put a stamp on them and it would work. The fourth section, which begins over here, is the transportation section. There were, of course, three segments to transporting the mail in 1847. You had to get the letter, the recipient had to get it to the post, I'm sorry, the sender had to get it to the post office. The post office had to move it to the delivering post office, and the delivering post office had to give it to the addressee, the recipient. There were actually a number of ways you could get it to the post office. The point I want to make before I begin is that this section shows all three segments, and it shows every possible way that mail could have been transported in each of those segments, and there are examples of it with an adhesive stamp on it. So getting it to the post office, you could simply carry it by hand yourself, or you could give it to a private carrier to take, or beginning in 1849, you could give it to a post office carrier to take. You paid a penny for that service. If you were staying at a hotel, you could give it to the hotel just as you can today, and they would get it to the post office for you. So there were numerous ways you could do it, and they're all shown here. The local posts used hand stamps, adhesive stamps, and even embossed envelopes before the government issued embossed envelopes. And there is an example of that in there, a very interesting cover front. Then it came time to move it to the next post office. That could be done by rail. It could be done by steamboat. It could be done by Mississippi packet boat. And in one instance, it was even done by a coastal vessel that sailed up the Atlantic coast from Charleston up to Philadelphia. Very rare cover, one of only two covers that has the word ship on it, because when it arrived, the Philadelphia postmaster marked it ship because it was on an incoming ship. All the ways that it could be done, it was done. And then it arrived at the post office, the final destination post office, and the recipient could come and pick it up or could use a local post. If they had signed up with the post office in advance and authorized the local post would pick it up and deliver it to them. And there is an example of that on the last page of that section. The fifth section is one that I personally find kind of charming. You recall I said that previously you had to pay per sheet. Now, envelopes were considered a sheet. So if you put a one-page letter in an envelope, that was two sheets or two rates that you had to pay. As a result, you very rarely see envelopes in the stampless era. Now that it was based on weight, as long as the contents of the letter and the envelope together weighed less than a half ounce, you weren't penalized. Envelopes started to show up. They were so unused that the first patent for the manufacture of envelopes was only issued in the U.S. in 1848, earlier in Great Britain, but in 1848 in the United States. And in terms of this exhibit, these envelopes that I show were really the pioneers, the forerunners of what would become the common way of sending the letters. Within 15 years or so, in the 47 era, maybe only 15% of letters were sent in envelopes. By the 1860s, virtually all letters were enclosed in an envelope. And these were the forerunners to them. And you have various types. You have homemade envelopes, of course. You have self-addressed envelopes, probably the earliest example of a United States self-addressed envelope. There are what we call ladies' envelopes, nicely small envelopes that you would use for private correspondence, either woman to woman or perhaps between a woman and a man, personal correspondence. There are letters that show corner cards, that are corner cards. We call them corner cards because in the corner there would be a little advertisement if it was a commercial letter. It would be an advertisement for whoever was sending it. Well, those eventually developed into what we call today a return address. There were advertising covers that became much more elaborate, but these were early forms of advertising covers. And you'll see examples where there is an advertisement in the corner and also somewhere there's an advertisement on the back flap. And some of them are quite interesting. A bookseller, and the little advertisement is in the shape of a book, and there you can see the pages of the book on that embossed corner card. It's a lovely group of envelopes. It has some embossed envelopes, very ornate, embossed around the edges, quite attractive. And then the most beautiful of all ornate 47 covers, the Valentine's. A Valentine cover with the original Valentine enclosure is also in that group. As I say, it's a charming group of covers and one that I personally enjoy very much to see them. We go on to the sixth section, and the sixth section is designed to show just how broadly and how quickly and how deeply these stamps were accepted and used in society. So that the first half of the exhibit borders on what might be called social philately, in that it talks about, or it shows, the most important political event of that era, the 1848 presidential election of Zachary Taylor and his running mate, Millard Fillmore, and the subsequent accession of Millard Fillmore to the presidency when Zachary Taylor died. So it begins with an early campaign letter, not for them, but for another party, seeking electoral votes for the caucuses. Probably the earliest example of the males used for national campaigning. It goes on to have letters that were sent just as the election took place, and congratulations, and there were there's an inaugural ball that's being held in New York State because Millard Fillmore was a New Yorker, and there's an invitation to the inaugural ball. There are letters, political letters, sent to a congressman advising him what to tell the new president as far as legislation that needs to be done. And the last part of that section is just a chatty little letter from a woman in Albany, New York, writing to a friend of hers, I think it was in Utica, city of Utica, long letter, and in it she mentions, oh yes, tomorrow we shall have the funeral procession of the president coming through our town. It's sure to make traffic terrible in the downtown area. And finally, Zachary Taylor did die, and the last The next day, Millard Fillmore took over, and there is a free-franked envelope of Millard Fillmore as president, one of only two non-adhesive stamped envelopes in the display. That one and the very first one, which is the last day of the stampless-only era. The second half, after we've shown that even the most important political event was adequately covered in mail that had stamps on them, I look at various postmasters, local postmasters, and the things that they did that show how well they accepted it. They would do things, they would make up their own kinds of cancelers if they couldn't find the right cancel. They would use different color inks. They would have fancy cancels. And you've seen in other covers, too, rating marks used to cancel stamps, words like paid used, which were unnecessary. The stamps were evidence of payment. It all goes back to the stampless era. They were just using whatever was at hand. They were moving the mails along. They were willing to go along with the system, and they wanted to help the system. So it goes to say that these postage stamps were accepted equally and at all levels by those who sent the mail as well as by those who processed the mail. They were clearly a success. In the seventh section, I show a selection of cross-border mail, mail with Canada, who, of course, at that time, Canada was probably our most important trading partner given its proximity. Very early on in the new United States, Great Britain had Canada work out a convention with Washington. Well, not Washington, but I guess they'd already moved to Washington. But anyway, they had a convention worked out to arrange for British mail to be sent via the United States up to Canada. This was because Great Britain needed to be sure of having a route into Canada, particularly during the winter when the St. Lawrence would be frozen over. So previous hostilities notwithstanding, we reached agreement very quickly, and this convention was put in place. And the convention provided for the fact that each country would charge its own postage, so that a letter coming from the United States would pay the postage to the lines, to the border, either 5 cents if it was coming within 300 miles or 10 cents if it was coming further away. Then it would be turned over to the Canadians, who would mark it, usually a manuscript, with the amount of postage due in Canada. There were no postage stamps yet in Canada, so it would be sent there, and they would pay in cash. At one time, there were also U.S. postage stamps available for sale in Canada. As a result, you'll see also letters that originated in Canada that carry U.S. stamps. They paid the Canadian portion of the postage in cash, and then when they reached the United States border, when they reached the lines, the U.S. stamp carried it the rest of the way. There are four basic breakpoints of distances in Canada, unlike the U.S., which only had two. And there are examples of mail carried to every one of those distances using United States stamps to get it to the lines. There's also a cover that I think will interest many people here, particularly those who are familiar with British colonials, and I'm sure just about everybody in the room is. There is a cover with a crowned circle postmark. For those of you who don't know, the crowned circle was indication that postage had been paid. So there's a cover in there that came from Quebec City, which was the only city where that was applied, because although the entire Canadian postal system was under the control of the Imperial Postal Service of Great Britain, the main office was in Quebec. So letters coming out of Quebec were marked and paid in advance, were marked with the Crown Circle date stamp. And there is one there. That could only happen until April 6, 1851, when the Canadian Post Office became independent. So it could only happen on adhesive stamps. The only U.S. adhesive stamps letters that could have the Crown Circle are the 47s, because the 47s were still current when Canada became an independent postal entity. There are about seven or eight of them, and that's one of the better strikes. You might enjoy seeing it. It goes on that frame to talk about the Treaty of April 6, 1851. On the same day that Canada took over the operations of its post office, it immediately had a treaty waiting with the United States, and a new system was put into place, a new through rate of 10 cents from any point in the U.S. to any point in Canada, excluding the west coast of the U.S. It would be 10 cents, and you had to mark the country of origin. You didn't have to used to do that before. There are examples of mail sent under the treaty. There's also an example of a letter sent before the treaty was put into operation that arrived in Canada after the treaty was in operation. So when the letter went out, the sender put a 10-cent stamp from Philadelphia and wrote pay to the lines, because Philadelphia to the border was over 300 miles. When the letter eventually got to Montreal, it wasn't assessed any postage because it had arrived after the treaty took effect. So the 10 cents paid the through rate to Montreal. There are, at the end of that section, there are a couple of illegal usages, including one has stamps after the issue was demonetized. On June 30th, 1851, the 1847 issue was demonetized. There are about 100 covers that have stamps used in the demonetization period. Only four of them go to foreign countries, and only two of those actually pay a treaty rate. The Canadian one that's at the end of that section pays the treaty rate, and it's one of the four demonetized usages to a foreign country. And speaking of final countries, the last section shows that although international mail was only a small portion of the system, the small portion of the total U.S. mail volume in 1847, these new adhesives were used on letters to and from the rest of British North America, New Brunswick and Nova Scotia, as well as to the Far East, South America, Great Britain, and to the European continent. In short, mail with stamps was sent to every destination to which 19th century mail was carried. There's some really interesting covers in there. Very quickly, I want to tell you about the cover front, the Treaty of New Granada. It is the only artifact extant that demonstrates mail carried under the Treaty of New Granada. It was New Granada today is Panama. And there was a treaty in 1844 between the U.S. and New Granada, which was Spanish-owned, of course. And this letter was sent to a Navy officer in Santiago, Chile. So it was sent first through the U.S. mails to the Navy Department in Washington. The Navy Department put it into a sealed bag, put it on one of their vessels. It was carried down to Chagres on the east coast of Panama. It was carried across the isthmus by New Granadian or Panamanian carriers. That was the point of the Treaty of New Granada, to carry mail across the isthmus. And then when it reached Panama City on the west coast of Panama, it was turned over to the Pacific Mail Steamship Company, British, which carried it down the Pacific coast to Valparaiso, where it was turned over to Chilean postal authorities who delivered it to Santiago. So it's a lovely cover and a very, very rare usage. Of course, the only use to Chile of the 47 stamp. The rest of the section highlights the importance of transatlantic commercial ties, particularly with Great Britain. It's a study, really, of U.S., Great Britain packet mail rates and arrangements between during the 1847 era, and of course, the examples are all covers that have 1847 stamps on it. So it begins in the pre-treaty period, where the rate was slightly different and the arrangements were slightly different. It evolves through what is known popularly as the retaliatory rate period, which was a reaction to a surcharge that Great Britain had placed on mail carried by U.S. vessels. That surcharge, known in the United States also as the discriminatory rate. But there are examples of retaliatory rate period cover, and even a cover carried by private vessel during the retaliatory rate period so that it didn't have to pay the extra cost. It took about 2 weeks longer to cross the Atlantic, but it saved about 32 cents in postage. And that section then concludes with the open mail, closed mail, and the standardized rates that were established under the Treaty of 1848. Finally, on that section, there's a cover front that is the second example of post-demonetization usage, paying a treaty rate, 24 cents, had to overpay it, it was 25 cents, and going to a foreign country. That particular one is the only example of a combination cover, 5 cent, 10 cent cover in the demonetized era. And that concludes that little transatlantic section. There are about 8 or 9 covers in it. It's also the subject of the booklet. If you haven't gotten one, there's one at the back of the room or just outside the door. Please feel free to take one. Of course, the very last cover is the last day of usage, of legal usage, in the United States, June 30th, 1851. The very next day, new stamps were issued, and now the lesson was getting to be pretty clear. Whereas only 4% of the post offices had received stamps previously, 100% of the post offices now received stamps. A one-cent denomination was added so that you could make up all kinds of rates, the carrier rate, the drop rate, the circular rate, treaty rates without having to overpay it. They made it all possible. And then they did something, again, taking a leaf from Great Britain. They put in a lower rate if you prepaid your mail, so that it was only 3 cents per half ounce, lower than it had just been. Lower still, only 3 cents for prepayment, but 5 cents if you didn't pay in advance. With those changes, it was only a matter of a few years because the use of stamps just soared in the United States, and within a few years, it became mandatory. You had to pay using stamps or stamped envelopes. Indeed, it was the 1847 stamps that showed that the system could be changed, and it was changed. Thank you very much again for coming, and if there are any questions, I'd be glad to try to answer them.
Certainly puts the first issue both into a social and a political perspective. Harvey does tell me that his collection includes a fair number of the stamps as well as covers, but it is today's study, today's talk, is putting it into that important perspective, and one which is a postal historian. I rate very highly, and I'm sure other people do too. Harvey, it's wonderful. Thank you very much. I guess that there are some collectors of USA early issues in the room who are deeply delighted that George V did not decide that it was an ex-colony that qualified for his attention. that sort of deals with your paper and your display. Thank you very much. It's normal to say the display will stay in the frames till 6 p.m. I think perhaps by agreement we might leave it up for 15 or 20 minutes for those who haven't had a good enough look or want to check back over something. So we'll take it down in a little while when people have had their fill. The next meeting is 2 weeks today. It's a 1 p.m. meeting. Given by the Academie Européenne de Philatélie, and we will welcome them back. And it only remains for me to say that wine and some snacks are being served in the large library. Ooh, the plaque! Sorry.
Oh,
the note didn't mention the plaque, and it should have done. Well done. Thank you, my friends. We have to give you this plaque to mark the occasion.
Thank
it's
you.
Got the name and the date on the back,
thank you.
And it's my great pleasure to give it to you.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Thank you all. Thank you all very much. And there is still wine in the library until 7 p.m. And please don't overstay that time, because we really do have to clean the place up and clear it afterwards. But thank you all very much for coming. I hope you've enjoyed this as much as I have. I was greatly, greatly overwhelmed by the...
You're very gracious. You are very gracious. Thank you all.